Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Julia Fashaw. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, John. How are you?
I'm very well. And you've written the Sector Focus this week.
That's right, on the UK rail franchising system.
Indeed, very good timing because there's obviously a lot of talk about renationalising the railways and we are in the middle of the political party conference season and that's a big, big thing that Labour are pushing was this week. Tom Dines, how are you doing, Tom?
Good, thanks.
You've written the cover feature this week.
I have, along with Harriet Clarfeldt.
And it's about basically ethical investing, although we don't call it that anymore because it's a bit of a turn off.
No,
it's got this catchy new name.
Well, ESG investing or sustainable investing, basically making money while doing good.
Indeed. And there's a little bit of a political angle to that as well. So they kind of tie up quite nicely. And over in the control room, Megan Boxall, how are you, Megan?
I'm good, thanks.
Excellent. And you have written about the Sky deal this week, which has finally,
finally
come to a conclusion.
Nearly 2 years. It's provided us with a lot of content in that 2 years.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I'll tell you what, I mean, we're gonna before we go into the sex focus, before we talk about the cover feature, we're going to do a little bit of the news this week, and I think you picked out a story each. Let's start with you, Megan. Let's talk about what the conclusion of this long-running takeover saga has been.
Yeah, so the conclusion is Comcast has won the bid after a sealed auction process.
That's quite unusual,
Friday.
Isn't it?
Yeah, really unusual. It hardly ever happens. And the reason that the UK Takeover Panel decided that they had to do that was because there was just a bit of a deadlock between Comcast and 21st Century Fox, which made the initial offer in December 2016. And that offer was £10.75 pence a share. Comcast eventually won Sky at £17.28, so, I mean, a crazy premium. It's actually a 124% premium to the share price on the day before Fox made its original offer. So people have made a lot of money from this deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Is Comcast going to make a lot of money for this deal? That's the big question, because with paying a premium like that, the numbers are going to be looking tight, you would imagine.
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite difficult for them to actually make a decent return. It seems like there's a few personality issues in there maybe that made them put the bid so high. That Brian Roberts, who's the chief executive of Comcast, has had a really long-running dispute with Bob Iger, who's the chief executive of Disney. Disney is in turn buying Fox. So this was kind of a battle between those two media moguls in the US. And in trying to get Sky, make sure that his bid was the highest. Yes, maybe he went too high. A £30 billion deal for a company which has, well, it's got 27 million subscribers in Europe, but it's not a particularly profitable company. It was 12.4 times EBITDA valuation, which is so much higher than what Disney is paying for Fox or what AT&T paid for Time Warner. And both of those are far more well-established companies. So, yeah, I think they've overpaid there.
Okay, I mean, the industry backdrop is quite interesting. You know, one of the reasons it may have overpaid is because it's incredibly competitive and you have lots of people out there launching new subscription digital platforms and Disney, I think, is one of them.
Yeah, Disney is about to launch its own digital platform. It's going to try and compete with Netflix. It's actually pulled all its content off Netflix in the US, and it's probably going to pull all of Fox's content off Netflix as well, which is, that's a big deal for Netflix, because between Disney and Fox, they're far and away the biggest content producer in the world. So it's not a great time for Netflix now that Fox and Disney are sharing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I mean, just tell us, I mean, Disney is a share we like. I think we have
the
shares
on
buy. Comcast, we haven't really looked at specifically as an individual company. But I mean, let's talk about Disney and where this leaves Disney, because that is the company in which we have I would say, not a vested interest, but
more of an interest than anything else, especially now UK investors aren't going to have access to Sky anymore.
Exactly.
Disney we like, and I think they have played an absolute blinder with this deal, because they have made this offer for Fox, which is a pretty generous offer. But Comcast also wanted Fox. Earlier this year, they made an own offer as well. Disney kept on putting its price up a little bit, and Comcast eventually had to say, no, we can't afford to buy Fox as well. We're just going to focus on Sky. Disney said, fine, but we also want Sky. But they put in a pretty reasonable offer. It was a £15 offer. Comcast ended up having to pay a huge amount of money, and Disney has said, okay, that's fine. we're now going to sell our current stake, or Fox's current stake, in Sky. So they're going to liquidate that asset. It's about $11 billion worth, which is great for Disney. That goes straight into their onto their balance sheet, sorts out debt, which is a slight problem for Disney at the moment. Not a huge problem, but it's going to be helped by selling that stake in Sky. And it's now got a competitor who's having to spend an awful lot of time and money integrating a platform in Europe.
Yeah, and I mean, Disney Fox, I mean, you think of the most important thing in these businesses, content.
Yeah.
They're a powerhouse.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing close.
No, Time Warner's the next biggest. Time Warner is the biggest individual company, but Fox Disney is going to be way bigger than that.
But in terms of the brands and, you know, the intellectual property it owns, I mean, it's popular stuff.
Yeah, and it reunites all the Marvel characters as
well. Oh, that's the best thing about this deal. Yeah. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're still sticking with buy Disney shares.
Disney, yeah, for sure. It's a good company.
All right. Thank you, Megan. Let's talk about booze. Julia, you have updated your tip on Diageo this week.
That's right.
Still looking good.
It is. Well, it's kind of a short-term hiccup on currency at the moment.
But there's not a lot companies can do about that.
Exactly.
A bit of hedging and...
Yeah, it's nothing to do with their strategy. It's just, yeah, some of the emerging market currencies haven't been doing very well lately. And so that was a very slight headwind for Diageo. So they put out this quasi-profit, not a profit warning, it's a cut to profit expectations, but they cut the forecast for net sales. But just considering the scale of the business, it was quite minimal. And shares hardly even moved on the day, too. And usually when you see something like that by a smaller company, shares drop quite substantially.
Yeah,
whereas Diageo, I think it just is a testament to strategies still in place, so investors still have confidence.
Again, a company that has an enormous portfolio of fantastic global brands.
That's right. Yeah, basically, most spirits or booze brands that you see in the stores, it probably owned by Diageo.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is the strategy? I mean, this is a big old company, global reach, where emerging markets a bit tough. Where's the growth coming from here? Why are we still confident in the shares?
I mean, I think what perhaps could have made of this update worse news was that they had been moving a bit more into emerging markets. And so the fact that the profits were cut because of something that happened in emerging markets I think it could have been interpreted worse than it was. But I think it's just the fact that it is just purely currency movements. It's got nothing to do with declining like-for-like sales that we know of anyway.
The U.S. was the big market for Diageo.
Yeah, the U.S. is still its largest market by far, but it's got such high saturation at that point. But they've been kind of pushing things like whiskies and scotches there, whereas things like Smirnoff Vodka are less popular than they used to be.
So it's sort of more premium brands.
Yeah, exactly. And just something different, too. I mean, like in the U.S., I think things like vodkas and gins and stuff were always kind of more of a go-to spirit as opposed to something like a whiskey, whereas now that's becoming a bit more popular and Diageo's trying to really capitalize on that. Same with tequila as well. I mean, tequila's always been popular, but last year they made that big acquisition of George Clooney's Casamigos tequila brand.
Yeah, that which markets itself, presumably being George Clooney's tequila
brand. Yeah, kind of what more marketing do you need there?
Indeed. No, it's interesting. I mean, I think that's a trend in this industry. I think David Beckham launched a whiskey.
Yeah, that's right.
Even though he doesn't drink, is that right?
Nope. That's what I heard. Yeah,
yeah, that's strange, but there you go. The power of celebrities. We're marketing anyway. We like Diageo. Still got the shares on a buy. Tom, yes. Shares we don't like so much, which on the front page of the news section. Mighty, not so mighty.
Absolutely, yeah. So essentially, we've had them on a sell for a while now, based on the kind of ongoing issues with the outsourcing sector. The shares were down because operating profit is going to be flat or lower for the first half of the year. They said it's primarily due to investment in various projects, cost-cutting projects, improving customer service, stuff like that. But if you look through the performance of the different divisions, it's essentially every division but two has some sort of problem that's going to impact profit or revenue. The two that don't account for a combined 24% of revenue.
Right. So is this a company-specific issue or a series of company-specific issues? Or is this the market just turning its back on outsourcing? Or what? A combination of the two?
Possibly a combination of the two. Each of the different divisions has very different issues that they're facing. So it's contract mix in cleaning, for example. It's outdoor sales have been affected in catering. And on top of that, they're expecting to miss the net debt projections and their cost-cutting program may have delays in showing benefits. So there's just every angle with Mighty, it's just bad all over, basically.
Yeah, so I mean, is SL in the moving in the right direction?
It's
when did what price did we sell it at? I can't remember
exactly, but it's down quite considerably on the original tip,
because there was a hope that the worst was, you know, baked into the share prices in the outsourcing sector.
Yeah,
in the wake of the Carillion scandal. You know, it was a bit of a tough call. Like, is this the nadir, or are things going to continue to worsen? And I think we took the latter view.
Absolutely. Well, in some cases, Serco seems to be getting its act together. And actually, the market view seemed to be that Mighty was improving. The short positions fell from 14 to 4%. Worryingly, they've crept up in the case of Babcock, which is a share we quite like.
Yeah.
So it's a mixed bag with the outsourcers, but it's less uniformly bad than it has been. But it's in Mighty's case, it's still not looking good.
Still a sell, then?
Yes.
Okay. Right, let's talk about another sector that's really been having a horrible time recently, and that is UK rail. Not a sector that I would personally ever invest in, being a commuter.
Yeah, at this point we don't have... the only UK transport group that we have on a buy right now is National Express, which has completely ditched its UK rail business.
Yeah, I love this. There's a brilliant quote from the chief exec.
Yeah,
Chris Davis, who said that he had... did he tell you this?
It was when I spoke to the chief financial officer at the last set of results. He told me, there is no way in hell that we are going to touch UK rail ever again.
Yeah,
and then the chief executive said if he ever decided that it would be a good idea for the company to go back into UK rail, that he hopes that the board would take him out back and shoot him.
I mean, that is not a glowing endorsement of the business opportunity in the UK rail sector.
Especially considering that National Express used to be the biggest UK rail operator.
Yeah, yeah, they used to run my franchise for a bit, actually. Don't anymore. Obviously, is anything going well in the sector for anyone in the rail aspects of these businesses?
Honestly, not particularly. I mean, commuters love to complain that there's delays or cancellations.
They would do that.
The government
anyway
loves to complain that they keep having to bail out different franchises. And the companies themselves like to complain that they're losing money all over the place. So it's just a really nasty place to be right now.
I mean, so there have been problems with service provision this year, particularly some specific issues around timetabling that caused all sorts of horrible problems.
Yeah, that was the Govia Thames Link changes to the scheduling that Go Ahead had to deal with.
It's since
been resolved. They say that since July they kind of did a revised.
That's the one that essentially brought Chris Grayling's career as transport secretary to pretty much. So what other problems have we got in some of the other franchises? I know there's been a lot of rebidding going on.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest
failures,
probably the biggest disaster of this year has been the East Coast franchise, where towards the end of last year the operators, that it's called VTEC, it's a joint venture between Stagecoach and Virgin Group, and they were supposed to run it. There's still years and years left on the franchise. And it was supposed to run until 2023, I believe. And then they were just running out of money. And so the government came in and said, all right, you can end it early, around like 2020. That was at the end of last year. And at the beginning of this year, they had to step in and say, the government has to fully take over running this operation because they've just lost so much money and they just can't do it anymore.
Yeah. But, I mean, so why is that the case? Because you would have thought that the whole business of running a railway is reasonably predictable, that you know how many passengers are likely to use the service, you know how much running your infrastructure is going to cost you, your rolling stock.
Yeah, well, the investigation into it, yeah, they're saying that more people were driving instead of taking their trains because fuel prices were a lot cheaper, and that the passenger numbers weren't expecting what they would be to begin with.
Mm.
And the government just thought these were all ridiculous.
Yeah, their revenue growth forecasts were punchy, 10%
a year. Yeah, 10% a year, which they were saying was absurd to begin with.
I mean, this is interesting, though, because the rail market has been growing like a train.
Absolutely.
I mean, since it was privatised, you've got some figures in here. You know, the number of people using the railways, the amount of revenue coming from the railways has grown substantially.
It's grown substantially, yeah. But it's just an incredibly expensive operation to run, clearly, because when you look at the recent results from those that are still in the business, like Stagecoach halved its dividend at the last set, so that the payments now rely on the business X rail. So it's kind of, it's almost suggesting that they don't really expect to win any more contracts.
Mm.
And yeah, Go Ahead reported a massive fall in profits. Same with First Group. It's in the rail division specifically, not necessarily a group level. But yeah, they're just incredibly loss-making franchises to run. And it seems like National Express just had the right idea to get rid of it altogether.
Yeah, it's a damaged sector, but it's one that is very topical because, particularly after Labour Party conference, renationalising some of these essentially kind of the infrastructure of the country is very high on the agenda. And I think you quote some figures in this piece suggests that there is a huge appetite amongst the commuting public for renationalising of the railways.
60% of Britons think that the UK rail franchise system should just go completely back to the government.
I mean, it does seem like there's a possibility of that happening by default. I mean, if
the Labour Party is very in favour of it.
Well, indeed, and they might get their way because if these private companies actually say, look, I don't want any part of this.
Yeah,
it's too hard to make money.
Then
somebody else is going to have to step in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess that kind of, and it could be the government.
Although,
why on earth would you? You know, if I was the government, which I'm not, why I wouldn't want to own something that was going to cost me an absolute fortune every year to run, with all the problems that come with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I mean, I just can't. It beggars belief that this would be any better, that they would be run any better.
I mean, at this point, does it seem like it can really get much worse? But it's, I don't know, centralizing it all under the government.
I think the rail networks were pretty bad in the sort of 70s and 80s.
That was
worse
around
than
them.
They are today, believe me. So yeah, there is this kind of weird dichotomy. You've got a sector that private companies increasingly don't want to be part of,
mm-hmm.
and you've got a government that kind of wants to take hold of it, but is going to be a money pit. You know, not exactly what the country needs.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have foreign operators, and this is the other big issue in this sector. My line is run by a foreign operator.
And which one is that?
It's called Greater Anglia, Abellio Greater Anglia. Abellio being the Dutch national railway. And they seem to do a really reasonable job of it. And I think it's really quite interesting in your piece that you suggested actually the direction in which rail investment is going means that it's not just... It would be nice to have foreign operators involved in our railways. We'll need them because they have the expertise that we don't have in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, the best example of that is the West Coast Partnership, where part of that is going to be running this HS2 high-speed system and from London going up north to Birmingham.
Not many fans of that project, incidentally, but...
Well, it seems like some foreign operators tend to be big fans of that project.
There's
no UK rail company that has the actual capacity to run a high-speed rail network. So they've had to partner up with different foreign operators to make their bid as like a joint venture.
Yeah, yeah.
Some with some French operators, some with some Italian operators, some from Asia.
I mean, it's fascinating that, you know, we there is this desire to renationalise the railways, but to keep the railways running and, you know, to the standard that we want them to be run, we have to invite foreign operators.
Yeah, in the case of high speed anyway, it's not a choice, it's a necessity.
Yeah, so you know, the future of this sector looks very, very difficult.
It's quite bleak at the moment.
Is there any reason to invest in transport businesses that, you know, the transportation of people?
I mean, we are...
On roads rather than in the air.
Yeah, I mean, like our only buy tip in specifically the UK transport sector is National Express. And they, at the last set of results, they posted record profits. And they're the ones that got out of the UK rail business. So clearly there's still money to be made elsewhere.
So
they also tend to have operations in North America as well that are doing quite well.
Yeah, so I mean, National Express, obviously most people would know them from the coaches
that's
network of coach routes that run around Britain. What are they doing overseas? So
they have a bus system in the US and a bit in Canada too, I believe.
Okay.
But yeah.
But that's it.
Kind of the only headwind there is that employment in the US is becoming so full that they're kind of having to pay their bus drivers a lot more so that they don't go and work elsewhere.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it's all going quite to plan.
But the plan, presumably, you know, to grow that business is looking overseas for opportunities to run similar networks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Seems quite sensible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there you go. Rail, avoid it. Unfortunately, I can't. Every day I have to spend a fortune on the trains and a lot of time as well. Mm. But my line, thanks
to the Dutch. Maybe don't buy shares in them.
No, don't buy shares in them. Tom, let's move to the cover feature. Again, this, I mean, there is a link here. The whole nationalisation thing, renationalisation, is kind of relevant to the debate about the kind of social, the role companies have to play in society. One of the sort of groups of companies at the core of that is Water. And obviously there's been a lot of talk this week about renationalising those guys as well.
Yeah, yeah, there has been. It's so the Labour Party conference that Labour unveiled its plan for renationalising the water network. I suppose the most pertinent points for our readers would be that any existing shareholders would be compensated with bonds, but the amount the government would pay would be decided by Parliament under the precedent set out.
Not by the market, then?
No, no. Set out is the under the precedent set out by Northern Rock, which is not really the precedent you want if you're...
Which went bust, essentially.
Yeah, yes, yeah. So whether Northern Rock is the same as Pennant, I will leave to individuals to decide for themselves. But it's basically, it's not where you want to be. But so essentially, yeah, that the legal precedent established in that case is that Parliament has the final say on how much it would cost. And it says, I've got the thing in front of me, it says that Parliament may seek to make deductions for compensation on the basis of pension fund deficits, asset stripping since privatisation, and state subsidies given to the privatised water companies since privatisation.
Yeah, so I guess the reason it links up to the feature is because, the water companies are a soft target for this kind of political rhetoric, this kind
Absolutely.
Of political...
Always have been.
Because of the way that they are perceived to have behaved, i.e. ripping off their customers.
Yeah.
Now, whether that's true or not, it's certainly something that many investors are now aware of, how companies behave.
Mm.
So, I mean, let's put water to one side.
Yeah,
this is kind of the horse is perhaps bolted here. Tell me about some of the, we call it ESG, environmental, social and governance. Governance is obviously what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, talk us through those three aspects of the sustainable investment process.
Okay, sure. So the sustainable investment essentially breaks down into two main strands, and sustainable and ESG and stuff like that, the terms are used interchangeably depending on who you speak to.
Yeah.
But essentially ESG is focusing on a number of factors under the umbrella of environmental or social or governance that relate to the performance of the company. So what are they doing with their waste? Or what's the employee diversity like? What's the management's track record, the independence of the board? All these various factors that will be more or less material for individual companies, but that holistically give you a pretty good idea of how sustainably the company is being run.
Yeah, so these will be screened for in the way that we may screen for financial metrics.
Yeah.
And what we're looking for here is companies that are behaving in a positive manner. So this is what we're calling positive screening? Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of.
That works.
So, explain to us, there are two aspects to... you can either negatively screen companies out of your investment universe or positively screen them in.
Yes.
So just talk us through those two concepts.
So,
it does, in fact, Julia, mean getting rid of half of your companies.
Yeah, I cover a lot of the vice stocks. Gambling, tobacco, booze, pubs, yeah.
All the fun ones.
Got it all.
Yeah, so the negative screening is, as you say, screening out things that would be deemed to be unethical. Ethics, obviously, it's a funny one. It has origins in, say, Islamic finance, where people won't invest in certain types of companies just on the basis of their beliefs. That's more an ethical choice rather than seeking a particular return. Positive screening is where you would look to, you have a belief in a long-term trend, say the drive towards renewable energy, and you would seek to maximise your exposure to that trend through positively screening for certain companies.
I mean, talk us through, as I said, the various aspects, ESG. Mm. What are we looking for in each of those areas?
So we've got in the feature, we've got a list of some of the common things that people look at. There obviously changes from company to company. You're going to be less worried about carbon emissions with, say, a marketing company than you would be with a car maker, for example. But under environmental, would be stuff like animal testing, their pollution and how they treat their waste, their attitude to their use of resources and the sustainability of that. On social, it would be things like use of child or slave labour, safety of employee conditions. And then under governance, it's a lot more of the kind of the stuff you would expect from just having a comprehensive investment process anyway. So it's stuff like executive compensation, companies, the level of tax the company pays and whether it seeks to avoid or evade any of it, any risks of corruption or bribery charges in any of its divisions and any anti-competitive practices they might be involved in.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And it, I mean, it does tie into the whole bit, the big political agenda that's going on, certainly, certainly on the Labour Party, that, that companies have essentially behaved in such a way that they need greater worker representation on their boards to encourage them to behave in a better way. But arguably, the market is doing a lot of this for them now. This is, this seems, these approaches seem to be becoming much more commonplace than they were, you know, even half a decade ago.
Yeah, absolutely. If you believe that, say, the water industry is being run irresponsibly, the only answer to that is not to nationalise the whole thing. The Ofwat, for example, is already increasing the responsibility on water companies to take customers into account, reduce their bills, invest for the long-term quality of the infrastructure, reduce leakages, stuff like that.
And these companies get rewarded for those kind of good behaviours.
Yeah. So,
yeah, and I mean, there do seem to be mechanisms that, that are being introduced that, that are improving the way that companies behave. And,
Absolutely.
And yeah, as I say, you know, the market seems to be doing some of this work already. One of the key questions about ethical investing and perhaps why it's not exactly been the most popular strategy in the past is that there was always a view that you had to sacrifice returns to be an ethical investor. Yes. Is that still true?
No, it isn't. Like I say, part of it is investing for a theme. So if you believe that there is a long-term trend towards renewable energy, then it's just as investable as any other theme. And then there's also, with changes to crowdfunding regulation and stuff like that, it's now much more accessible for individual investors to invest in, say, offshore wind projects and things like that through platforms such as Abundance, which are popping up at the moment. So the opportunities are proliferating. It's just a case of finding the right ones.
Yeah, and there's lots of ethical funds out there, you know, mainstream providers offering these things, you know, people like Baillie Gifford, for example, Legal & General. I think it's four ethical funds in our top 100 that are specifically ethical funds. And I think a number of others within the top 100 use ethical criteria to some extent.
Absolutely. As well, I think, big business.
I think a lot of companies do. A lot of, you know, non-ethical funds are starting to use these ethical criteria. I think one of the things that you discuss in the feature and that Alex Newman discussed in the secondary feature is that actually you have to understand the kind of environmental impact of these companies, the social impact, because that is a kind of determinant of how viable they are as investments for the long term.
And absolutely.
And he's in the case of Alex's feature, looking at oil and gas.
Yeah.
One way to get yourself away from those risks is to sell them entirely. Okay, thank you, Tom. Right,
you.
So plenty more in the magazine this week. Lots of results, and I think we're going to start to calm down for a little bit now, which is good. The usual tips, lots in the personal finance and fund section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. All the usual comment, plus quite a bit of other news, actually. It's been a busy week. Thank you, Julia. Thank you, Tom. And thank you, Megan, over in the control room. Clean up how what's good for the planet can be good for your portfolio. Available in all good news agents. And we'll be back on this podcast next week. Thank you very much.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.